This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Though few doubted the outcome, the speed and ease of the military victory in Iraq is sending shockwaves through the world political order. There are, as Bush administration officials have noted, new realities. The reduction of a once-feared military force in a matter of weeks leaves no doubt of U.S. abilities to project power across the globe. Recalculations are underway. At stake are issues as large as the Korean Peninsula and as subtle as the Russian political elite. This hour, we're going to look at the international impact of the war in Iraq, which countries and interests stand to benefit and which to lose. And we're taking your calls. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. What do you want to know about the change in the international balance of power? How will countries and institutions that oppose the war try to adjust to the new situation? How might those that supported it benefit? How have the bruising global arguments left institutions like the United Nations, the European Union, and NATO? 800-989-8255, totn@npr.org. A bit later in the program, we'll look at the post-war view in Russia and East Asia, but joining us now is Ivo Dolder, a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. He joins us from their studios. Ivo, good to have you on.
Very glad to be here.
Big picture, how large an impact has this war had on the international stage?
A very, very large impact. If you remember that before the war, there was a major discussion and then major disagreement between the United States and Britain on one side and virtually everybody else on the other side about whether this was the time to go to war. We found a world deeply divided over that question. We found major international institutions that had been the pillars of the current order that we have been living with since the end of World War II, shaken at their foundation, from the United Nations, which debated this question in detail and was unable to come to a conclusion on what should be done, to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has united the United States and Europe for more than 50 years in a common alliance. Major alliance was shaken as well. So we walked into this war with quite a dust-up, and we're walking out of the war with very little of that having been resolved or even taken care of.
Well, before that dust finally does settle, can you describe for us what is at stake as we look ahead in the post-war world?
Well, what's really at stake is the way in which we have organized our relations with the rest of the world for some 60 years now. We had for those 60 years an American foreign policy that in the main tried to work with major allies, Western particularly, in Europe and in Asia, to develop common policies with regard to the main issues of the day. And we used multilateral institutions from the United Nations and others in order to maximize our impact, maximize our ability to get things done. What we have seen, in part because the administration believed that the threat it faced was so significant that it had to act by its own, is that those institutions are at least broken. They're perhaps not yet completely removed from the picture, but they're broken. And the question therefore becomes now, how are we going to conduct our foreign policy from this point onwards? Are we going to try to re-establish relationships with those organizations or indeed with those allies with whom we had the major disagreement that we had, or are we going to do this virtually on our own? Have we learned a lesson here that says, you know, we are so powerful, we can actually do virtually everything we want to do by ourselves, and apparently we can achieve not only what we want to do, but we can do so at relatively little cost? That's, I think, the question we now face.
Obviously, we're seeing all this through the scrim of the war, obviously, but isn't there a lot of other stuff going on that there's, you know, there have been a lot of changes that we're now seeing more clearly because of this one big event?
I think we're seeing very clearly that the use of military power can, in a very short order, bring about fundamental change in a country as far away as 7,000 miles. Let's just think about what we did. We went 7,000 miles away from home, and we took on a major country with a major military, and we got rid of that regime in 21 days. That must have some impact on similar regimes in other parts of the world, who now have to consider the possibility that the United States may be inclined to do a similar kind of tactics with it, or more importantly, believing that that is the case, may decide to change their behavior, as may in fact be happening with Syria, where 2 weeks of tough talk is now, according to the president, at least what he said yesterday, is now leading to greater cooperation with us on the question of former members of Saddam Hussein's government being handed over, handed back apparently across the border, as happened yesterday with his son-in-law. So it is possible that, having shown real muscle, we can now have a greater credibility in the world with regard to our ideas and our policies.
One of the things that many countries in the run-up to this war said they were worried about, and more than countries, but a lot of people around the world, was that this might set a precedent not just for the United States in terms of its ability to go out and change things militarily, but that other countries might decide to do that as well.
Well, it's certainly one of the things one has to be worried about, because the United States has now arrogated to itself the decision on when and how it can use force. It is no longer... it doesn't find it necessary to have other institutions, or indeed international, the UN or other institutions, to give legitimacy to those acts. So you could see countries like, say, an India or a Russia deciding that their national security requires them to act preemptively, be it against Georgia because of terrorism threats, be it against Pakistan because of the combination of both terrorist and nuclear threats. So it does open the possibility of organizing the world along a rather different kind of framework than we have been used to. That is one in which power and the ability to use it is more important than rules and norms that have long been the mainstay, whether real or not. At least one has pretended to work according to those rules and norms in the past. So it does open the possibility that other countries may follow suit, and it's not clear to me that that is something that is in the American interest.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address again, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's take a call from Sanjib in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question was somewhat just addressed by your guest. And the question is basically how the military solution was approached and applied to Iraq, how that would now impact dialogue between India and Pakistan, and how that dispute will be addressed by United States, as it does not really have the same ground to stop India from taking a similar action anymore. It would be almost considered hypocritical if it tries to stop. And at the same time, United States has not really been able to exercise its power and influence on Pakistan from supporting terrorism against India.
Ivo Dalder?
Well, I think Sanjib is right that one of the problems we have created potentially with this action, with an action that really was a war of choice based on the proposition that there was a threat not today but sometime in the future, perhaps, of Saddam supporting terrorists and perhaps weapons of mass destruction, that there are various places around the world in which similar circumstances may arise. And clearly Kashmir and the Pakistani support for Kashmir separatists, the fact that you have a government that has nuclear weapons that is potentially unstable, poses a threat to India at least as severe, at least as threatening from New Delhi's perspective as Saddam Hussein did to the United States. And it becomes very difficult, therefore, for the United States to say, should India decide to act, that that is an unwise course. We would have to then make that case on the merit. We can't make it anymore in terms of the international rules and norms that used to exist but have now been broken by our very action.
Sanjib, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Throughout today's program, we're going to look at specific areas where the war in Iraq has had an impact, and we're going to start in Asia, where the most pressing issue is the nuclear weapons crisis in North Korea. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly left Washington just today for talks on this issue with China and North Korea. Sitting quietly next to Ivo Dulder in the Brookings studio is James Steinberg, director of the institution's Foreign Policy Studies Program, and thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
James Steinberg, Baghdad falls the next week. Pyongyang is willing to sit down to talk. So is it really that simple?
Well, there's no question that the countries in East Asia, and particularly North Korea, have been watching the situation in Iraq very closely. We've all noticed that the head of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, disappeared for some 50 days, even before the start of the war. And reports from visitors who've gone to North Korea since then have said that the country really is in a state of panic over the possibility of war. So there's no doubt that this is having some impact both on North Korea and on North Korea's neighbors.
In a sense of panic in that the United States encouraged that its success would be able to do things that the North Koreans would be disturbed about? Or on the other hand, how was that image of statues being hauled down in Baghdad? There wouldn't have been many in Pyongyang who got to see that, but the effect must have been startling.
Well, it certainly has an effect on North Korea's leadership, and I think that there's a complex calculation here, and we really don't know how the leadership ultimately will read it. On the one hand, they may be seeing the American military might and saying, boy, we ought to not run that risk ourselves. We better get back into line. But the other lesson that they might learn is Saddam Hussein's mistake was not that he challenged the United States, but that he didn't have a nuclear weapon before he challenged the United States. And so some believe that this may actually cause the North Koreans to accelerate their effort to acquire a more substantial nuclear arsenal.
Mm-hmm. And while the United States and China and North Korea sit down for multilateral talks, though the Chinese may just be ushering the other two into a room. Who knows exactly how that's going to work. But this arrangement seems to have left South Korea out in the cold, at least for the moment. What's the situation and the appreciation in Seoul?
Well, in South Korea, the concern is the exact opposite of the problem in North Korea. The South Koreans are deeply concerned about the risk of war in the peninsula, and they believe, for the most part, that the greatest risk of war at the moment comes not from North Korea, but rather from the risk that the United States will do something precipitous. And so the message from the South Koreans is, yes, let's try to resolve this problem, and let's try to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. But under no circumstances should we be threatening military force, because that could trigger a catastrophe with the risk of hundreds of thousands or so South Korean deaths.
Mm-hmm. Ivo, let me turn to you before we go to the break. And that's a question about, you know, if you look back 12 years and sort of the debut of this, you know, blitz of precision-guided munitions and all that sort of thing in Desert Storm, as Tom Friedman, the columnist for the New York Times, has pointed out, that was a status quo conflict. The idea was return the world to the place where it was before Iraq invaded Kuwait. This one, he argues, is very different and revolutionary.
I think he's right. We are in a very revolutionary period, and it is being driven by the strongest nation in the world, which is us. And I don't think that the world is necessarily comfortable with or even aware until very recently that what we have is a revolutionary power directed by, I think, a quite revolutionary administration that is bent on, because of what we saw on September 11, on trying to remake the world in a way that makes it fundamentally more peaceful for the United States by bringing democracy to the Middle East, by making sure that rogue states don't have weapons of mass destruction, and by trying to root out the terrorist training camps and cells that exist around the world. And this administration has shown that it is willing to go on the offense in a quite striking and radical and ambitious fashion without necessarily having to wait for others to join it in that task. And that is a big change.
We're talking about tectonic shifts in the international situation in the wake of the war with Iraq. What are your questions about how the foreign policy situation looks now? We'll take more of your calls when we come back from the break. 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. You can also send us questions on email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about foreign policy shifts after the war with Iraq, which countries and interests gained on the world stage, and how things have changed. Our guests are James Steinberg, director of the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and Ivo Dolder, a senior fellow in that program. They join us from Brookings Studio here in Washington. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go right back to the phones. Our next caller is Philip, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, good afternoon, Neil. How you doing?
Very well.
And good afternoon to your guests. My question has to do with the United Nations. We know that the United Nations sends some inspectors in North Korea with cameras and stuff to keep eyes on them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, for 12 years, put sanctions on Iraq as well. North Korea took down all of the equipment and sent everything out. And the United Nations haven't done anything about it. In fact, North Korea threatened the United Nations that if they took the case to the Security Council, they would declare it as a declaration of war. Saddam Hussein has been overthrown, and the weapon haven't been found yet. And our president is calling for the sanction to be lifted off Iraq. So where do the United Nations stand? Who called in the shot?
Well, there's a good question. James Steinberg, you want to try the first part of that?
Well, I think the questioner has really identified a real challenge to the consistency of the administration's policy. It's clear that, on the one hand, it's been a kind of unilateral and military-oriented approach to Iraq. On the other hand, the administration extols its commitment to multilateralism and diplomacy with respect to North Korea. I think there's a very clear reason for that, which is that in the case of North Korea, the prospect of war is enormously dangerous for an important U.S. ally and for the United States. And North Korea may well have nuclear weapons of its own. It certainly has the military forces to cause grave harm. And so the instinct is to tread softly, softly, whereas with Iraq, the administration had greater confidence that a military approach would work. But in the administration's defense, I would say that with Iraq, we had 12 years of a UN Security Council resolution which demanded Iraq to disarm itself, and Iraq flouted that for a long time. We are still at a different stage with North Korea. It may get to that, but I think the administration is right at this point to try diplomacy with North Korea.
Philip, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Wanted to check in on the view from a couple of other important East Asian vantage points, and that would be, of course, Beijing and Tokyo.
Well, the interesting thing about the developments in East Asia is that we focused a lot during this run-up to the war on the amount of opposition to the United States and the use of force. But in fact, in East Asia, the governments and some of the publics have been surprisingly supportive. And that's because for Japan and for China and for South Korea, their goal is to make sure that the United States is willing to listen to them on their concerns. And the best way to do that is to be supportive of the United States on the United States' concerns. So they basically have been saying to the United States, okay, we'll back you on Iraq. Please pay attention to us on North Korea. Now, that's been very clear in the case of Japan, where the prime minister was very supportive of the president. Surprisingly, in South Korea, right after a new president was elected who had been seen as anti-American, he actually agreed to sending non-combat South Korean troops to Iraq. And finally, in the case of China, although they were not very supportive, they certainly were not the kind of critics that Russia and France were. So most of the play in East Asia has been, let's keep our powder dry on Iraq so we can have more influence on the United States to take into account our concerns on North Korea.
James Steinberg, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it. And now let me introduce Lilia Shevstova, who's with us here in Studio 3A, chair of the Russian Domestic Politics and Political Institutions at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. Good of you to be with us.
Hi, Neil.
And Ivo Dolder, of course, is still with us as well. Lilia, when the go back to that same question from Russia's vantage point. There was some hand-wringing I saw at a news conference today in Moscow about how well the Chinese had played their dissatisfaction with American policy as opposed to the way the Russians had played their dissatisfactions with American policy. How do the Russians position themselves now?
Well, Russia is split on the issue, but, you know, more and more pundits and even people within Putin's team, they are quite concerned about Russia siding too much with France. And now there is a desire to do fence mending, to do damage repair. And Putin himself is trying at the moment, you know, to repair the relationship with Bush and to make sure that Bush would come to St. Petersburg in the end of May.
There was a meeting of, the three, the summit, that was portrayed in Russia as a meeting of the losers.
Well, yes, to some extent they were losers, but if we compare Putin to Chirac and Schroeder, Putin has still much wider field for maneuver. And if Putin makes a really terrific decision, if he sides with Blair, Putin may become even a bridge maker between two parts of the West.
If he sides with Blair?
Oh, yeah. If he moves a little bit behind from Chirac's back towards Blair and joins Blair, you know, in trying to bridge, you know, the rifts between the allies, Putin can get even increased international leverage.
Hmm. I wanted to read an email and get both of your reactions. It goes back to the question of the United Nations, which I think is very high in a lot of listeners' minds. This from Sam Connect in Wichita. It seems to me that as long as one member of the Security Council can veto any motion introduced, that the UN cannot be expected to be an effective policeman for the world. Will it be necessary to restructure the Security Council, if that's possible, so that it can be an effective preventer of wars? Ivo, are you...
it is absolutely true that one member can, in fact, veto military action. Remember, in 1999, when a vast majority of the Security Council wanted to intervene in order to stop the genocide or the presumed genocide in Kosovo, Russia was opposed. But under those circumstances, it was still possible to get another international organization, in this case NATO, to support it. So there are ways around it. The problem with reform of the Security Council, of course, is that it needs to be approved by the Security Council, which means reform can be vetoed. And it may well be true that an organization that reflects really the power structure of 1945 may not be the best way in which to organize the world in the year 2003. But the reality is that I don't see any of the current veto-bearing members giving that veto up. And as long as that's the case, real reform is not going to happen.
Lilia, I don't think Moscow is going to give up its veto, do you?
Well, it will be very difficult for a decayed superpower to give, you know, the last remains of its superpower role. But it seems to me sooner or later Putin or any Putin successor, if he's a pragmatist, would understand that Security Council has outlived its role.
To go back to the phones, our next caller is Frank, who joins us from St. Paul in Minnesota.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, just one real quick comment and then a question. Okay, my comment is that I had heard we had spent over $400 billion on our defense budget, and Iraq had spent like 1.5, a little over that, on theirs. So my comment is that we are really not in the same ballpark with Iraq, and it really was just we weren't fighting a military superpower there. We just kind of went over there and used our preemptive military force to basically take over their country. And the reason I bring that up is because my question has to do with the Project for the New American Century, which is based upon developing and using that preemptive military power to more or less coerce or impose our democratic values and our capitalist ideals throughout the world. And I'm just wondering, maybe from Russia's standpoint or some of the other countries out there, if they're aware of what that agenda is, and that we are actually veering away from any diplomatic solutions, and we're using the preemptive military force to actually kind of move our agenda forward. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air on that.
And we'll get some answers. Let me just remind listeners, I think the Project for the New American Century was run by William Kristol, among others, and published, what, 4 or 5 years ago. But anyway, Lilia, from Russia's point of view?
Well, from Russian point of view, you know, the doctrine of the preemptive strike is quite familiar for us, because we probably have been initiators of this doctrine in the mid-50s. Well, it was a military doctrine of the Soviet military-industrial complex. And since then, we have used several times this doctrine against our neighbors in the Eastern and Central Europe. And so we know also the consequences of the preemptive strike against the threat that exist in our own imagination. Thank God, you know, the Soviet Union does not exist any longer, and I hope that the United States will deal with the preemptive doctrine in a much more cautious way.
Mm-hmm. Ivo Dalder, and let me ask you to frame your question in terms of the war on terrorism.
Well, on Frank's comment on mm-hmm. that we're spending $400 billion and Iraq is spending $1.5 billion, he's absolutely right. But the United States spends about 40% of all the world's military expenditures to spend on American military force, which really means that this country now is only facing countries like Iraq and can, in short order, try to use military force to change regimes, and that has become the essence of.
Would you include Russia and China as a couple of exceptions there?
Well, even the Russian military expenditures are not at the level of what they were during the war, during the Cold War. I would argue that there are a number of large countries that we have no interest in changing their regimes, in part because the regimes have already been changed by themselves or are in the process of changing. Though many people before September 11 who are now supporting this kind of policy, of course, were very concerned about China. As the what Mr. Bush during the campaign used to call the strategic competitor of the United States, and we're looking towards China as the rising power to be opposed. On the question you asked in terms of preemption and terrorism, what's interesting is that there is no debate, it seems to me, both within the United States or indeed abroad, about the use of military force to preempt a possible terrorist cell or terrorist training camp, or if we had known that September 11 was happening and we knew it was being organized in Hamburg and we had taken that, used military action or worked with the Germans to take that out, nobody would have objected to that. What's novel, what's revolutionary indeed, is the notion that we should use military force in order to change a regime that we don't like or that we believe poses a threat to us. And we now seem to have the capacity to do that, at least militarily. Whether we have the capacity to build a democracy is something that we will yet have to see in Iraq. But it is that is truly unsettling. We have the capacity, it appears, to take out a variety of regimes, whether it is in Iraq or in Iran or in Syria or in North Korea. And that is deeply unsettling to the world because we haven't drawn any rules or any norms or institutions for determining who decides whether we should or should not do that.
Lilia, let me ask you again in the context of the war on terrorism. Russia is still involved heavily in Chechnya. Does this change things in terms of that whole relationship?
Well, it changes things, you know, from the American and West European perspectives because, you know, all Western partners and allies were so cautious and toned down their criticism of Russia's war in Chechnya because everybody wants to have a Russia in his boat. That's why there exists a kind of Faustian bargain, as I call it, you know. France and Germany want Russia to be within their own coalition. Bush wants to have Putin on board. That's why nobody criticizes Russia for any excessive measures, you know, in the Northern Caucasus.
Here are some of the top stories today from NPR News. The U.S.-appointed civil administrator for Iraq, General Jay Garner, has arrived in Baghdad. He says his first priority is to restore basic services to the people, including water and electricity. In the meantime, tens of thousands of Shiite Muslim pilgrims have gone to Karbala to honor the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Some are demonstrating against U.S. military occupation, first time they've been able to make that pilgrimage in many years. NPR Scott Simon is in Baghdad. Steve Inskeep is in Karbala. We'll hear more from them later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're still talking about changes in the world political order with Ivo Dalder of the Brookings Institution and also with Lilia Shevstova of the Carnegie Project. And let's go back to the calls. Our next caller is Kathy, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi. I just had a question about terrorism in particular. Our actions in Iraq were viewed as perhaps something that would increase the amount of terrorism around the world. We haven't really had any major terrorist attack here in this country. And I'm wondering if our actions in Iraq could not only be having an effect on rogue states, such as North Korea, but what the effect might be on terrorists like Osama bin Laden, if it's really realistic to assume that it will propagate more terrorism, or perhaps, since terrorism is a political act aimed at a goal, for instance, Osama bin Laden on September 11th was wanting us out of Saudi Arabia. Now we're not only in Saudi Arabia, now we're in Iraq. Could that be a deterrent to future terrorist acts?
Ivo Dalder?
Well, I think Kathy asks a very important question that it's sort of difficult to know a definitive answer. On the one hand, clearly, there is the view that one of the reasons Osama bin Laden did strike the United States on September 11th is because he believed that we were weak, that it was our weakness and our failure to respond to previous terrorist incidents from the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 83 to the involvement in Somalia, where Osama bin Laden had a role in 93, to the bombing of the World Trade Center in 93, to the bombing of Koper Towers in 96, and the coal in 2000, and the African embassies in 1998, that we never really had a major military response, and that therefore that weakness, as some would have it, provoked this kind of attack. If that's true, then the kind of military action we've seen over the past year and a half, both in Afghanistan and now in Iraq, is sending a very, very strong message that this nation will be willing to use whatever force is necessary to defend the United States, and ought to lead to a reduction in terrorism. An alternative view, one that, for example, Tom Friedman has been writing about, is that, well, weakness may be one part of the equation. The other one is a deep dissatisfaction with U.S. policy in much of the Arab and Muslim world, and that in order to, and it is these angry young men who have very little to lose in societies in which they are deeply repressed by governments that happen to have American support, that they turn against, with little hope, turn against the United States and use the kind of tactics we saw on September 11. If that's the case, and if our actions are seen in Iraq not only as ousting a regime but as occupying Iraq for oil and other reasons, then one would expect terrorism to increase in the days and weeks and months and years ahead. And the fact that we haven't had a terrorist incident in 29 days, I don't take necessarily as a sign that we won't have it either in the next 29 days or the next 29 days after this. This is a threat that can strike us at any moment and is not necessarily going to be tied to a timetable, electoral or otherwise, that we might wish.
Kathy, thanks very much for the call. And thanks to our guests for being here. We appreciate it. Lilia Shevstova heads up the Russian Political Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. She was with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much
Thank
for coming
you.
In. And Ivo Dalder is the Senior Fellow at the Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. And we appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
When we come back from a short break, the past, future of, past and future of Iraq's education system, historian Phoebe Marr will join us to explain why winning the hearts and minds of younger Iraqis may be a little bit more difficult than expected. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.